AFUO.org. Look for the CUW logo in the sponsor section. Joining us by phone today, Greg Baylor, Senior Counsel and Director of the Center for Religious Schools at Alliance Defending Freedom. Greg, welcome back to Faith and Family.
Great to be with you again.
And the Reverend Bart Day, Director of LCMS Office of National Mission. Bart, welcome back.
Great to be with you again.
And Terry Schmidt, Director of School Ministry in the LCMS Office of National Mission. Terry, welcome back.
Happy to be here with you this morning.
This is part two of our discussion on issues that Christian schools are facing today. As we were wrapping up yesterday, we were talking about Title IX and some of the issues surrounding that schools may face and the value of requesting a religious exemption and what that means for schools and some of the other issues surrounding Title IX. Before we get into other issues such as Title VII, Greg, anything else about Title IX that you'd like to address before we go on to Title VII?
Well, it bears noting that this is not just a hypothetical problem. Many of your listeners may know that there's a Wisconsin Synod Lutheran school in Wisconsin that has been hit with a charge of discrimination under Title IX. Based on a claim of gender identity discrimination. It's actually not an individual student that experienced something that they didn't agree with. It was an activist organization called the Freedom From Religion Foundation that heard about a letter that the principal circulated, basically setting forth the school's views on these controversial issues of marriage, sexuality, and gender. And this activist organization didn't like that and thought it was inappropriate for a school that's receiving some federal benefits through the school lunch program to simultaneously receive those benefits and, quote, so-called discriminate. So according to the latest press accounts, the school itself has not received the complaint, but if they do get the complaint and it goes to the Department of Education, they actually filed it in the wrong place. If it makes its way there, it seems to me that one of the things that the school would consider doing is to assert that religious exemption. So I raise that story just to illustrate that this is not a hypothetical future thing, but it's a real thing that's happening now.
Questions, gentlemen, here regarding...
Maybe one other case. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a Wisconsin Synod school, but Greg, do you want to make any comment on our LCMS school? We have the Columbia versus Pauley that's on the docket to be heard by the Supreme Court. It's not the first time the LCMS and a LCMS school, the Hosanna Taylor case, has found itself in recent years before the Supreme Court. But Trinity Lutheran Church of Columbia and their playground issue, is there any helpful information to share with folks about that situation and that case that's pending?
Yeah, it's a fascinating and terrific case, and I'm glad that an LCMS school is sort of the carrier of this issue to the Supreme Court. When I first started doing religious liberty work back in the mid-1990s, the issue that's presented in the Trinity Lutheran case versus Pauley is the kind of issue that I was confronting all the time. Over time, things have switched to all this non-discrimination stuff and associational freedom. So in a sense, this feels like an old-school Supreme Court religious liberty fight. But it does have a twist. Let me explain what's going on there for the listeners who aren't familiar with the case. The state of Missouri has a very fine program where it kind of kills two birds with one stone. It collects old used tires that would otherwise end up in landfills. And shreds them and produces this sort of meltable, pourable rubber that is poured into the surfaces of playgrounds to make those playgrounds safer for children. And they have obviously a limited amount of rubber, so they take applications. A lot of schools, daycare centers, public and private, and all of the rest. Well, Trinity Lutheran in Missouri filed an application, and they, whatever criteria the state used, they were high enough on the list to be one of the scheduled recipients of this protective playground rubberized material. But they never got the rubber for their playground. The state said, hold the phone. We believe that as a matter of church-state separation, we cannot give you this rubber. Why is that? Because it's a church that operates this school, and we believe that it's legally impermissible for the government to directly fund a house of worship. Now, you know, that's a view that's been around for a long time. Back in the earliest days of our country, there was a backlash and outrage about the government taxing people to pay ministers' salaries. And I think it was appropriate when the states disestablished their churches and stopped paying ministers' salary. I think that's been good for the state and good for the church. But the question is whether the good principle that animated those decisions means that you have to punish Trinity Lutheran School in Missouri, that you have to discriminate against them, you have to deny them some benefit that really, you know, can't be diverted to an inherently religious use. So the interesting thing about this case, among others, among other interesting things, is that the state is not saying that the federal establishment clause, it sometimes characterized as separation of church and state, which is not what it says, but they're not saying that the First Amendment requires them to discriminate against this church. Instead, they're saying that state law requires this. A state constitutional provision requires this. What did the school say in response? The school said, okay, whatever, maybe so, but you cannot discriminate against us just because we're religious without violating another piece of the federal First Amendment, the Free Exercise Clause. So it's a really, it's kind of a battle of competing legal principles. The facts of the case are sort of really good for our side of it. It's, you know, I mean, it really, does it make sense to deny safety for students whose playground happens to be connected with a church? I don't think so. So it's a fascinating question, but it identifies one of the other obstacles that sometimes come up when religious entities try to interact with government. The first one we talked about yesterday, the non-discrimination rules. The second one can be this, hey, we're not going to allow you to participate in this program because it would violate separation of church and state.
Gentlemen, any other thoughts on Trinity and Columbia?
No, I think it's great for our listeners to just have a little update on what's happening, particularly, I think, with our Wisconsin Synod school there in Baraboo, and we'll be curious to see how that progresses. I think a lot of LCMS schools are looking at that because that's touching on the very issue that they're most fearful of, this entanglement under Title IX and theological positions on gender, sexuality, marriage, and accepting those federal dollars and then that intersection.
Greg, during one of the breaks, you mentioned Title VII being an important issue that we should address. What is Title VII about?
So, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 is one of the most significant pieces of legislation in our history, certainly the most significant piece of civil rights legislation. It has a series of titles, and these titles or sections, groups of provisions, address different contexts. You know, there's one about public accommodations, restaurants and hotels. There's some about schools. But there's one about employment, and that's Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And it says to covered employers, which is basically anybody that has 15 or more employees, that you can't discriminate on the basis of a series of protected characteristics, including sex and religion. This law has been mostly not problematic for religious institutions. Obviously, schools like yours take religion into account in their hiring decisions, but the religious exemption in Title VII protects their freedom to do that. I have no doubt in my mind that all of your schools are sufficiently religious to qualify for this religious exemption. And I suspect that not many of them have experienced a problem where someone goes to the EEOC and says, I was discriminated against on the basis of religion, because that claim is not going to succeed because of that religious exemption. But I mentioned a minute ago that religion is not the only protected characteristic in Title VII. In addition to race and national origin, the word sex is in there. Well, that used to not be much of a problem either until the federal government collectively and the EEOC specifically started saying what the Department of Education said in the Title IX context, which is that the word sex in Title VII includes gender identity. So if you ask the federal government today, does Title VII ban gender identity and sexual orientation discrimination, their answer would be yes. Now, this is really ironic, I think, because there's been an effort in Congress to amend Title VII to explicitly add sexual orientation and gender identity that's been going on really since the mid-90s, and that has never succeeded. Of course, the premise of all of those efforts was that Title VII needed to be amended, that it didn't already ban sexual orientation, gender identity discrimination. But the EEOC's view, just like the Department of Education's view, is that word sex, it's always been there, and really there's always been a sexual orientation, gender identity, non-discrimination ban that we're just now sort of discovering. All right, so suppose that's right. The question then is, am I, as a religious school, subject to that ban? Which is a different way of asking the question, does the religious exemption that's already in the statute, that's been in there since the beginning, does that protect me from claims of sexual orientation and gender identity discrimination, or does it only protect me from claims of religious discrimination? The answer to that question is, we don't know. It's a debated question. There are plausible arguments on both sides of the question. I happen to think that the religious exemption is available in response to a SOGI, sexual orientation, gender identity, claim in the employment context under Title VII, because you can't divide religion between doctrine and a list of beliefs and the moral practices that are associated with that religion. Folks on the other side of these issues like to do that. They want the exemption to be narrow. They want maximum non-discrimination protection for sexual minorities. But I think the better reading of the law is that, yes, the religious exemption protects you. We don't really have a lot of case law, certainly not on this particular question yet, and I suspect that some judges will decide it one way and other judges will decide it the other way. It's an open question right now, but I, in terms of my advice, I would not advise schools to simply say, well, we think we're bound by this newly interpreted ban on SOGI discrimination, so I'm going to stop having those sorts of criteria for my employees. I would not do that. I think that's unnecessary.
We've talked about this a little bit, that we have faced questions about employment in the past, right, with the Hosanna Tabor case. How would this be different when it comes to, as you said, SOGI claims?
Yeah, the thing about Hosanna Tabor is that it's very powerful, but very narrow. It's powerful in the sense that the doctrine the Supreme Court embraced and articulated in that case essentially protects a school from almost any kind of employment-based claims. But the scope of that protection in terms of which employees it applies to is relatively narrow. As I'm sure most of your listeners know, the doctrine at issue in that case was the ministerial exception. How big is it? What do you need to do to successfully invoke it? And I think the most significant question is, who counts as a minister? And that's the answer to that question is sort of a gray, blurry-lined category. Now, the good thing is that the Supreme Court seems to take the view that it's a broader category than one might expect. It would have been disappointing if the court had said only those people who are ordained and perform sacerdotal functions and preach and administer the sacraments and all of that, those are the only people to whom this ministerial exception applies. That's not what they said. They said that the exception was available in the case of a teacher who was a commissioned teacher who had a certain amount of theological training that was necessary for her position, that prayed with students. There was sort of just enough there for her to qualify as a minister. So I think certainly the ministerial exception would be available in some cases of Title VII SOGI discrimination claims, but not in all of them and probably not in most of them.
So, Greg, do you give us any advice around hiring practices and vetting employees that would be different now with this sort of ambiguity of Title VII?
No, I would not change it at all. If I were to change it, I would, you know, do the things that we've already been recommending, which is to be clear and to root your views about gender identity and homosexuality clearly in your religious convictions. Cite scripture, cite church documents, cite things that make this, that reflect the true reality that this is a manifestation of your religious belief and not just some sort of animus or bigotry towards gay and lesbian and transgender people. That will help as we make the argument that the religious exemption is available in this context. It'll also help us make kind of the backup argument if that doesn't work. I would argue that in many circumstances, if the government punishes you for taking adverse action against an employee who engages in behavior contrary to your faith, that violates your religious freedom. And it not only is protected by this exemption in Title VII, but it violates rights that you have under the First Amendment and under the federal religious freedom statute called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. So I think the advice is consistent with what we've been saying before, but it gives you just yet another reason to make sure that you do this and connect it up with your religious beliefs.
Greg, maybe just to make this practical, we can put all these things in place, but it doesn't mean any of our schools are going to be immune from lawsuits or, you know, being spoken ill of within their communities. So what happens when that actually takes place, when a school is being sort of legally challenged or it's happening, it's spreading in the community? What kind of actual steps should schools take when they find themselves maybe sort of like St. John's in Baraboo, Wisconsin? They haven't received anything yet, but that's certainly been out in the news. What do schools actually do?
Yeah, I think these days you have to make two responses. One is a legal response and one is sort of a public advocacy response. There are plenty of circumstances where the law's on the side of the institution, but they get clobbered in the court of public opinion and capitulate because of that. So I think, number on the legal side of it, contacting a qualified attorney early on to help is an important step. It's always a shame when the lawyer gets called after the mess has already been made. don't be afraid to call soon. And, the local attorneys that your schools work with, the resources that are inside the LCMS and ADF, were all resources that are available to you if something comes up. And it just positions you. I mean, we've seen enough of these that there's certain patterns and there's certain things that you can do to kind of diminish the possibility that the thing will blow up. So, again, we encourage that. On the public advocacy side, you know, there's this temptation to just say no comment. And that, I think, is counterproductive. You know, we live in a world where there are plenty of media outlets. The Internet is endless. And I think that there's a way that we can get out our positive message, that we can frame the controversy in a way that's not provocative, that's not inflammatory, that's not hateful, but instead explains who we are and why we do what we do in as loving and winsome way as possible. But I don't think it's a good option to just, we'll lay low and let the other side frame the issue and offer its facts without rebuttal. So I would advise both those things if these sort of controversies arise.
And I think that's exceptional. I think our listeners should be very aware of the fact that for our schools, whatever level they are, when these issues come up, both legally and in the court of public opinion, to let us know at the Synod headquarters. We have Synod Legal Counsel. We network with all of these other organizations like ADF. So, I mean, we are here to try to help schools in the midst of those legal entanglements. But likewise, we have professional communication staff here. We understand crisis communication management. We help congregations and schools and districts with those things also. So, you know, please don't feel yourself all alone on an island if and when these issues come to your back door. Please let us know. The Synod wants to be a helpful resource and advocate in any and all ways that we can. We have pledged to stand with our schools in the midst of these issues so that they can remain faithful and true to the gospel and educating the children of the world. So we're here for you. Please let us help you.
I would just urge schools, when challenged, to take the first step in going to their district and advising their district
Absolutely.
That they have been challenged. Then we're happy to be brought into this situation, but start at the district level. A lot of districts have legal representation that is available to them and can advise and assist at that level. But we also want to know. So districts and national level stand behind your schools in supporting you in the right of religious freedom.
Greg, earlier, I think we were still talking about Title IX at the time, but you used a phrase that caught my attention. I believe you said that our schools are sufficiently religious. what does that term mean? What do you mean by sufficiently religious?
Yeah, you know, Title VII says that essentially religious organizations, associations, societies, corporations are exempt. Well, that, you know, it kind of begs the question, what counts as a religious association? What counts as a religious society or corporation? And over time, Congress didn't say, by the way. So the courts over time have sort of fleshed out what those words mean. And I think they've come up with a pretty generous, inclusive test. I think one thing is nonprofit status is certainly a very important attribute of an exempt religious organization. And by the way, I think it's important to clarify that our conversation right now is just about federal Title VII, its religious exemption. It's very important to note that almost all states and many municipalities, counties, cities have their own non-discrimination ordinances, and they have their own religious exemptions, some of which are narrower than the relatively broad federal exemption. So I don't want this to be taken as a discussion of all of these non-discrimination rules. But the courts and the EEOC have said, you know, what is your function? What do you do? I mean, if you're producing a secular product, you're probably not going to be a religious employer. If you're for profit, you're probably not going to be. I think the boundary cases are so kind of far away from what your schools are and what they do. You know, they're connected with a church, they're doing education, they're nonprofit, they incorporate religious faith into the curriculum. The fact that they actually they hire based on faith is actually a helpful thing in invoking the exemption. It demonstrates the seriousness of your religious convictions. But I think this is, at least at the federal level, it's mostly a non-issue. It's like you're so within the boundary lines as, you know, K through 12, LCMS, religious schools, that it's not something I worry about. I do sometimes worry about state exemptions, and I obviously can't speak to all 50 of those in the time that we have left, even if I knew all the details, which I don't.
I was just curious if it meant we had to, you know, cover a certain amount of scripture in when you're seeing a certain number of hymns in order to be sufficiently religious. With just a few minutes left, about three or four minutes left, what do you think is the outlook for Christian schools, particularly for Lutheran schools? What do you think the outlook is for us for the next decade or so?
Yeah, I worry that we're going to go through some troubled times. The folks on the other side of these issues are very clear in what they think and what they want. What they think is that those of us who believe that homosexual behavior is wrong, those of us who believe that responding to gender dysphoria with chemicals and surgery and cross-dressing, they think that those of us who believe that those things are wrong are the functional equivalent of racists, of people who think that African Americans are somehow inferior to white people. That is what animates them. That is what many of them either believe or at least say they believe, because it's a useful device to get what they want. If that's true, think about how the law and the culture treat racists, and I think appropriately so. It marginalizes and punishes, which in that case I think is absolutely right. But I think we need to maintain this distinction. I think many people in America, even if they support gay rights and same-sex marriage, I think they still believe that there is an important difference between a religious body saying, you know what, in our church we just do traditional marriage, we don't do opposite sex, or we don't do same-sex marriage. I think a lot of people still believe that, and we need to make sure that that's still true. So the folks on the other side have said what they believe. They've also said what they want. And what they want is they want no benefits from the government to be available to a religious entity that, quote, discriminates on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity. These things that we've talked about in Title VII and Title IX are not the only contexts where this is occurring. You know, the federal contractor executive order that the president signed, things going on at the state level, show this wave of trying to shrink or eliminate religious exemptions. There's a bill pending in the Congress. It's probably not going to go anywhere, but it does reflect, I think, the radical and extreme nature of the people on the other side. They want to amend the Civil Rights Act to add sexual orientation and gender identity. There will be, in most contexts, non-existent exemptions. They will partially repeal the Religious Freedom Restoration Act so that religious organizations can't invoke their rights under that in defense of these new statutes. So I think that we're in for some difficult times, and there may be choices. We may, at the end of the day, have to make choices about whether we're going to maintain who we are or whether we're going to maintain receipt of a government benefit. I think K through 12 schools are much less vulnerable because of the relatively the small amounts of government money that they get. It's a lot easier for you all than for, you know, say, the Concordia system that depends on student aid that comes from the federal level. But, you know, I do have hope. There are lots of people who are willing to adhere to biblical about marriage. I think that's been very encouraging to me. And if we don't capitulate, I think that we can get through this and get through it together and be a good witness for Christ and his gospel.
Bart, earlier, I believe it was in yesterday's program, you mentioned a resource available to churches and schools. Can you remind us and how to get our hands on that resource?
Sure. Protecting Your Ministry, that's been co-branded by the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod and ADF. That will be mailed in the middle of July to every congregation and every school of the Synod. ADF will be at the Synod Convention and will have hard copies also available. And I believe after the mailing goes out, we're going to make that available on the Synod website to be downloaded. And again, it should be a very helpful resource in giving you some statements of faith, some things about employment and facility usage policies. So please keep an eye out for that document. People have been asking about it. We've been working very hard with ADF to bring that to fruition.
We're very grateful for our partnership with Alliance Defending Freedom. Greg Baylor, Senior Counsel, Director of Center for Religious Schools, Alliance Defending Freedom. Greg, thanks for being our guest today on Faith and Family.
My pleasure. Good to be with you.
Terry Schmidt, Director of School Ministry, LCMS Office of National Mission. Terry, thanks for being my guest.
Thanks for this opportunity, and thank you very much, Greg.
And the Reverend Bart Day, Director of LCMS Office of National Mission, thanks for being my guest.
My pleasure.
This concludes our two-part program on schools, the issues that schools are facing today. More Faith and Family on the way here on Worldwide KFUO. Today's presentation is an encore presentation. Any dates or events mentioned in the program have already occurred. You're listening to Faith and Family. I'm Andy Bates, and we have more conversation about engaging parents. We talked about engaging parents at work and engaging parents to take advantage of that time off. Now we're going to talk about engaging families, engaging parents with schools, and what's that relationship between school and parent. We'll talk about that today with Dr. Rebecca Schmidt, Associate Director for Lutheran Schools School Ministry here at the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Becky, welcome back to Faith and Family.
Thanks, Andy. It's always my pleasure to be here. And what a great topic, one near and dear to my heart.
Absolutely. Now, let's talk a little bit about, I know we've talked about this before, your background in education and your path to coming here to the International Center and working with others in LCMS schools here at the IC, working with Terry Schmidt, the director here. Let's talk a little bit about your background as an educator, a teacher, a principal, right, as well?
Yes, both. Mm-hmm. All of the above.
Well, let's talk about those early years when you were first teaching and you were so excited about being a teacher.
Well, I actually began my career in education in an early childhood center, and I was a 4-year-old lead teacher. Mm-hmm. And worked in that area, welcoming children, getting to know parents, and actually that foundation has been an excellent preparation for the following experiences that I had as teaching in kindergarten, working as director teacher, and then principal in 3 different schools, and then on to the International Center.
Your work as an educator, you do all this, you do your education, you're 4 years plus to prepare to be a teacher, and then I'm sure have gone on for more education as an educator, now Dr. Rebecca Schmidt, and all this study, this education focused on teaching a child. How much of that time in education as an educator prepares you to work with parents, to engage parents, to partner with parents in teaching their children?
You know, that's a great question, Andy. And as I think about it, our preparation focuses on very strongly on what children should know, mm-hmm. and the methodology for teaching children. But we find and we know from our own experience as educators, as parents ourselves, that engaging a child's parent is first and foremost and such a crucial part of the educational experience, mm-hmm. for families.
When did children come into the picture in the Schmidt family? Had you been a teacher for a while?
About 3 years. Mm-hmm. So at that time I had worked in the child care center for 2 years and then had been involved in serving in a kindergarten classroom when I had my first child.
So children come into the Schmidt family, and how did that change your perspective as an educator, having children in your own family? Did it change your perspective?
Well, I think it did. Certainly a much greater understanding and empathy for parents, mm-hmm. and being highly organized in the classroom and then being at home and managing a child's relationship and everything that happens before that child reaches the door was probably one of my better educational moments. And so when we look at that, we reflect and think, how can we make this transition from home to school, mm-hmm. and what are the ways that strengthen that relationship?
Relationship, that's the word that keeps coming up over and over again. Why are relationships key? Why are they important in education?
Well, imagine this. And just as you had asked me, Andy, imagine this is your first child, mm-hmm. and your child's first experience in a preschool, or if you have older children, it's their first day of school in a new school. And it isn't an instant acceptance, and it takes much preparation. It takes time, and it takes caring teachers to mm-hmm. make that all work.
Absolutely. I know for us, I mean, we are, this coming spring, I think we'll be 1 year into preschool. Our son started around 18 months, and he was the young one in the class, you know, in his 2-year-old class. He was the young one and kind of the somewhat shy. So he's in the same class this year, this academic year. And so he's the older one. He's been there for a while. He knows how things work on the playground. He knows how things go in the second grade, or in the 2-year-old class, the busy birds. And He knows how that works. And so there's a new incoming freshman class, if you will, of new preschoolers, those 18 months around there coming in. And we can see the teachers and my wife and I can see how he's changed in the classroom a little bit now that he's one of the older kids and he knows a little bit more about the culture of the classroom and is kind of taking the lead on some things. It's kind of interesting how just how those relationships have developed in the classroom, relationships with the teachers, with the other kids, and certainly, obviously, with us as parents as well, how he's stepping up.
Well, the great part about this, Andy, is you've been able to reflect on that and experience what your son's experience was in the classroom. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't happen by accident. The fact that you were able to talk about how he's grown mm-hmm. and where he was when he began and where he is now. Lots of conversations have happened with your school, and your school has done a good job of preparing mm-hmm. and allowing that conversation to happen and to assure about benchmarks and mm-hmm. and progress and adjustment and all of the aspects of caring for a whole child. So in when we look at these kinds of things, we look at how do we build a trusting relationship? And for you to feel comfortable knowing that your son is being well cared for mm-hmm. in a safe, loving, and Christian environment is pretty critical.
Absolutely.
And so we start at the beginning. All of these foundations are built before either a parent or child sets foot on a school's campus. So those first impressions are mm-hmm. important. And each of these pieces, there are systems in place that will help build that relationship. A first impression. How did you find out about the school? Mm-hmm. Is the word of mouth positive?
Mm-hmm. A school's reputation in a community is worth a lot, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And it's supported in a number of ways. What was the phone call like when you called to request a visit or a tour? And was the school organized? Was the material organized? Was your greeting warm and welcoming and inviting and purposeful? Was the site clean and attractive and also inviting? And so all of these pieces are helping you to build that relationship. And more importantly, in that, did you have a good feeling about the staff? Was the school administrator, the principal, or the director asking questions about your family and getting to know more about your son and the things that you're looking for? And then that follows up with how did the visit go? And it really just is very, very important in all of those steps.
Sure. That's kind of the beginning of the relationship. It starts with you find out about this school somehow, whether it's through word of mouth, somebody in the community, or you find out because you're looking for it specifically online or in a directory or something like that, and you find the school. But that first impression is really important. Absolutely.
Absolutely. So once you're established at your school, there are many, many other small, subtle components that also create that invitational setting. A home visit, maybe, perhaps, mm-hmm. by your a parent.
Which is something I think, as a Lutheran in Lutheran education, is perhaps maybe unique to us. I don't know, not entirely, but I don't ever recall seeing that in any other education setting. But, you know, as a student who went to public school most of my life, home visits were just unheard of in the public school setting. So I think that for us, that's something that's unique and perhaps foreign to some families. That might be a shock to some families who are new to Lutheran schools.
And I think the key is adjusting. The home visit is a powerful experience for the child, for the parent, and for the teacher. Mm-hmm. Everybody gains in being able to visit ahead of time.
Now, as a teacher making a home visit, are you just looking to see how clean our house is?
I'm looking to see what kind of treats you serve also. But the most, and of course we laugh about those things, but
those are the fears, legitimate fears of some parents.
Oh my goodness.
They're going to see how messy my house is. Well if you have a toddler.
Well, we always take the oath. I promise not to report anything that's said here. If you promise not to report anything that's said here, but that home visit is so powerful for children. Mm-hmm. And in my own children's experience, they looked forward to the time that the teacher would visit. Today, we have many options that accomplish the same purpose. Perhaps it's a visit to the classroom ahead of time with an opportunity for the child and teacher and parent to just visit and explore the classroom, drop off supplies. And so the importance is the connection before the first day. And how do we help children and families become acquainted with the classroom and routines, and it's these are great ways to do that.
Can we go back to the home visit for a minute to alleviate some fears? I know we were joking about it's not about how clean your home is. What are some of the typical things that you would do as a teacher in a home visit just to help the parents who are new to Lutheran schools or new parents understand that what's going to happen in a home visit so that they're not afraid about the teacher coming to our house?
I would just use it as a chance to just get to know you. Mm-hmm. And this is, I would bring something for the child to have and to hang onto their refrigerator. I love to bring clips. This is for your artwork that you'll be bringing home and special things that you're doing. This is a time I would leave contact information and a monthly calendar. Mm-hmm. and talk about what parents can do to support their child's education. Lots of it is just questioning, answers, mm-hmm. and questions, and of course that a child usually has something special they want to show the teacher, and so that takes time too.
Pet or something, yeah.
Rubbed many dogs' ears and cats' ears, and visited many special places. Inside mm-hmm. and outside.
I think for a parent, this also serves as the foundation for that dialogue, that ongoing dialogue between parent and teacher. Don't you think that begins, you learn each other's communication style a little bit in that conversation, this kind of one-on-one time, or well, you know, family time together with the teacher, that really can create the foundation for that ongoing, hopefully ongoing dialogue.
It does, and it continues on through the year. And this is a great time to do this because it's getting acquainted, it's sharing with each other, and it starts that relationship. So when later, if there is a need to get together about a conference or mm-hmm. a specific activity in the classroom, that foundation is there. And you exchange ways to how best to contact us. And it may be by email, it may be face-to-face, it mm-hmm. may be by a phone call. And you're really getting to know how best that we can work together to serve this child that we're going to share for the year.
Hmm. Certainly sharing in that, you're right, that's a partnership.
It absolutely is.
All right, so home visits, and you said maybe even making a visit to the classroom beforehand is certainly another helpful way to learn more, help your child make that adjustment to
absolutely.
Their classroom, help the parent make the adjustment.
Absolutely, and there's many different ways that takes place. It can be popsicles on the playground. Who could resist that? A chance to get out and exercise, and then everybody shares a popsicle on the mm-hmm. way home. But another thing that we like to do is to connect a mentor family, especially with new families. And this is an experienced family that knows the ins and outs of a school. And when you're new, everything is a question. and as hard as we try from the school side of things, we try to be clear about communication, but it just, what seems perfectly clear to us doesn't always seem clear to a family. So here's a number you can call and say, well, I don't know what that faith family is. What am I supposed to do something with that? And here's someone who can say, well, this is how it works and mm-hmm. what your child will experience And do I need to bring anything? No, the teacher will take care of it. And so these are ways. And then additionally, this mentor family connects people to events and helps them get started, introduces them to other people, because our goal really is that they connect to the whole community, not just to the teacher, mm-hmm. and that this becomes a place where they feel welcome and more importantly, engaged.
I'm glad you brought up the million-dollar question when it comes to a school function. Do I need to bring anything? And does it need to be homemade or can it be store-bought? And that having that mentor family, you can ask that question without judgment, right?
So often a family might think, well, this is such a silly question. I should know the answer, or I don't want to bother the teacher, or I don't want to bother the principal. Mm-hmm. But we need to know. And
sure.
So we want those communication pieces to be in multiple forms. Hmm. And that's important too.
Great idea. Mentor families. I love it. How about that first day of school? What happens on that first day of school? I know for some families, it's especially, you know, preschool or kindergarten, that first day of school can be kind of an anxious time.
It is. And those are probably my two favorite days, the first day and the last day. It's not like selling a boat, but it's because families are in and they're excited. And so many of our schools just allow for that, so that you can walk your child in, take them down to their room, greet their teacher, help them find their spaces. Now, of course, this is a little different than high school, but there are also... many ways that each level of our education work to provide that connection with parents. In our younger ages, some of our schools provide the boohoo room, where a parent can drop their child off at kindergarten and then come down and have a donut, and as they tearfully say goodbye to their beloved child, and at the same time they're connecting with parents. Mm-hmm. And
we call it the boohoo wahoo party at St. Mark's. Yes. Yeah, it's yeah. The boohoo, yes, for the same exact reasons, but then the wahoo is because there's a whole new chapter in our lives.
That's probably the difference between your first and your third also. We don't have too many third child boohoos, so But the welcoming feeling, the this is my place, this is a place for our child is all key in that as mm-hmm. well.
What about through, well, anything else about establishing that relationship before we move into the day-to-day things?
You know, I think too, the part that I think about is we want a solid foundation of trust. And by that first day, and all of these pieces lead to that. And then as we continue through the year, we're going to continue to strengthen that foundation of trust. And certainly we talked about communication. It needs to happen in multiple forms, through newsletters, through blogs, through social media. Mm-hmm. Certainly the print, the tried and true works, but it may be in paper, it may be online on the website, it may be a push out in an email blast. And blogs add another dimension that have really strengthened that relationship. A teacher in a classroom may spend a lot of time at the end of the day or the end of the week and post highlighted pictures. They may describe an activity, and here you it brings the parent into that classroom. And so the long faces of "what did you do at the end of the day" is not always met with "I don't know, we played." Instead, you have a view into the classroom. Social media also brings the here and now for families. And as schools work through a multiple ways with a general Facebook page or mm-hmm. a classroom blog with a closed group, the whole key is to communicate what's happening in the classroom. And again, mm-hmm. that can involve parents on a number of ways.
our school for the preschool does just, it's kind of like a check sheet of things that, possible things that might have happened during the day. And they just mark off the things or write in a little note on certain lines on there just to give us an idea of what happened. When did they have snack? What did they have for snack today? How did he do during nap time? Did he sleep or was he awake? Was he disruptive or was he just quiet during that time? What was his mood throughout the day? All those things that they can just mark off on the check sheet. What toys did he play with or what games did they play? All those things, they do a nice job of communicating that to us so that at the end of the day, when we sign out, get a little piece of paper that tells us, gives us a summary of how things went that day and what happened at school that day. So it gives us something to talk about, too, on the drive home as well. I really like that.
Excellent. Excellent. And that kind of communication when it's daily is mm-hmm. powerful. And imagine what it would be like if you had not had any communication until parent-teacher conference time.
And then we find out that our child has been talking everyone's ear off for a whole month. Yeah.
As he should be.
But he's not. He's not. He's doing just fine. I love my son. Well, that regular communication is really key, I think, to me as a parent, feeling comfortable approaching the teacher and asking questions as well, because I know that, well, that they're paying attention to what my son is doing on a daily basis in the classroom.
One of those things that you talked about, Andy, which our parents love, is the use of text. Mm-hmm. You are getting communication in real time, which has been very powerful. And just imagine as a parent, and you may have experienced this yourself, you're dropping Oscar off for the first day and it's a tearful goodbye and he's clinging to a leg, or maybe not.
He clings to mom.
and how hard that is for mom to leave and know that he's going to be okay. And then 20 minutes later, she may get a picture text of him playing in a block center or uh-huh. off and engaged, and what a lift that is.
Sure.
And so here we see where schools are. We need to be sure as parents that our child is safe and cared for and functioning, and because if they're not, we're not able to carry mm-hmm. on in our roles either at home or at work, and so. Our goal in schools is to make this helpful for parents and not to build in barriers mm-hmm. or to make it more difficult.
With just, we are almost out of time here. I know, it went so quickly. The importance of these trusting relationships helps us, helps the education of the child in a number of ways. The aspects of that education are not just academic, but so many other ways, spiritually, certainly, as well. Building these relationships is so key, and I'm so grateful for the Lutheran schools that do that, that work so diligently to build these relationships with parents, with just about, maybe 20 seconds, 30 seconds, anything else about building these relationships, Becky?
Absolutely. Love those you serve with all your heart, all your mind, and all your soul, and all your strength. There is no commandment greater than these.
Indeed. Becky, thanks so much for being our guest today. It was great to have this time with you. Dr. Rebecca Schmidt, Associate Director of Lutheran Schools, School Ministry for the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod, the Office of National Mission. Thanks for spending some time here in studio with us.
You're welcome.
Listen to Faith and Family Monday through Friday at this time. Faith and Family is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for Faith and Family to continue. Our address is 1333 South Kirkwood Road, St. Louis, Missouri, 63122. You can contact us on the web and download Faith and Family at KFUO.org. Worldwide KFUO, on the air, online, and on demand.